You're listening to Future Ready Through M&A. I'm your host, Scott Slater, Vice President of Practice Management and Consulting at Fidelity Investments. We're about to kick off today's episode, but before we do, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or visit us at go.fidelity.com/mergers and acquisitions to listen to more episodes and to get the latest M&A insights. We began the Future Ready Through M&A podcast 4 years ago to help advisors navigate this important strategy. It may be hard to believe, but 5 or 6 years ago, it was challenging to get firms to consider just what is their M&A strategy. And when asked, nearly everyone identified themselves as a buyer. Well, the last few years make it clear, as we see all this M&A activity, that there are many sellers, too, driven by forces like succession planning and owner demographics, attractive valuations, and the need for a better operating platform and scale. But is M&A just about consolidation and scale? Or is there a deeper business-building strategy involved? If you look at many mature and capital-intensive industries, M&A is often a means to improve scale and capital deployment in an environment of shrinking margins. And we witness firms in industries like that that consolidate after a period of rapid innovation to one of achieving greater productivity. And M&A in our industry has certainly been a headline grabber for the last several years now. But is that because of the maturity of the independent wealth management space, and is it about consolidation? Well, listeners to the past episodes of Future Ready Through M&A will recognize that that's not our perspective. In fact, take a look at the Cerulli data, which points to the growth in the number of independent RIAs being formed over the last several years. It's still increasing. So if you consider many of today's recognized serial acquirers, M&A enables these larger enterprises to attract talent in a competitive world, to develop specialized wealth management skills, you know, the functional specialization that you often need to move up the advice value stack, as we call it, to help advisors better meet the needs of their clients, to leverage their brand and geographic presence. And I think this is an important one, too, to create unique career opportunities because of some of that specialization that otherwise might not be available in a smaller enterprise. In short, our perspective is that all the M&A activity has actually heightened the level of entrepreneurial creativity and service innovation for more clients. For this episode, I've invited two of the founding members of Fidelity's M&A Leaders Forum, an organization we started in December of 2015, to join us for a discussion on how M&A can be a means to build a better and more creative, high-performing enterprise. Marty Bicknell, founder and CEO of Mariner Wealth Advisors, and John Copeland, founder and managing partner of Wealth Partners Capital Group, which is the Florida-based investor in fast-growing firms such as MAI and EP Wealth, and more recently Merit Financial Advisors in Appella and WA Asset Management. They joined me on a panel last fall at our Inside Track conference, and they're each returning to Future Ready Through M&A after speaking with us several years ago. In fact, I encourage you to take the time to listen to what Marty had to say 4 years ago about the importance of finding the right fit partner in an episode we called Control Your Destiny, and also to my discussion 3 years ago with John and MAI's CEO, Rick Bunicore, in an episode we entitled Organic Growth First, Then M&A. In other words, the importance of making sure you have a high-performing organization before you start looking at an inorganic strategy. There really was some great wisdom on both of those episodes from these individuals that has already stood the test of time from both of them. Today, we're going to talk with John and Marty about their experience over the last several years in this heady M&A environment. Between the two of them, they've completed close to 90 transactions over the last number of years. In particular, we'll ask them about how they use an M&A strategy to achieve their objectives, and why they have made decisions to invest in or divest of a particular business at a particular time, and what it will take to be successful as an independent wealth management business in the future. Well, let's get started. Marty and John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Many thanks, Scott.
Both of you have been at this M&A game for quite some time now. I think, Marty, you said you did your first deal like back in 2011. And John, you formed Wealth Partners Capital Group just about 5 years ago. And we know that M&A is definitely more competitive now than 5 years ago. We've been setting records the last several years in terms of activity and assets under management and some of the creative deals we see out there. So from each of your perspectives, is M&A today more complex? Is it more difficult? And if it is, how is it different today than when you all were getting started 5 and 10 years ago?
I think you said it. It's definitely more competitive. I wouldn't say that it's any more complex than it was in the beginning. There's obviously more deals. There's more firms coming to market. There's also more competitors out there that are interested in buying those firms. So I guess if anything is more complex, it's that we've had to have a larger team that's focused on getting through all of the deals. And, you know, for example, we looked at 100 unique opportunities in Q1 alone. So I wouldn't say the deals themselves are more complex, but finding the right ones may be.
John, what about you? What's your perspective on, is it more complex and more difficult today?
So Scott, I would agree with Marty, which is the answer is yes and no. There are more buyers in the marketplace, and that means more informed sellers, right? So less education is needed in the early conversations, and it's always better having discussions with sellers who are more prepared. So that's a good thing. But obviously in a more competitive environment, it's just tougher to get your message across. Valuations tend to be higher, and you know, the chance of doing any particular deal is just less. So more difficult? Yes. Better? Probably yes.
You know, actually, John, one of the things you mentioned that I remember from when we first started the M&A Leaders Forum back with both of you back in December of 2015, we really had two objectives come out of that. One is better reporting, but the second was, could you help sellers become better prepared and better informed about the process? So that's encouraging to hear that we're seeing more prepared sellers out there who are understanding that better.
I think that's absolutely right, Scott. I think we're seeing that kind of across the board, almost regardless of size of firm.
What are your leading lessons or observations from your experience after many transactions? I mean, Marty, I think you've done, 41 transactions to date. And John, under the Wealth Partners Capital Group umbrella, I think you've done over 50. So that's a lot of transactions. What are your observations?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, the number of sellers, as we've both mentioned a couple of times, just continues to increase. And as John pointed out, the education that it takes back when we first started this in 2011 and through 2012, 80% of our communication was education. Today, we just don't have to spend as much time doing that. The time today is spent more on talent evaluation and really making sure that the culture is correct for both organizations and that there's, you know, really a great opportunity for, you know, the two organizations to do something they weren't able to do on their own.
And that tells me that you're more likely to build an enterprise that's going to really thrive and grow. And we'll get into that a little bit. That's a bit of our theme today.
There's greater interest among more RIA owners and advisors today in thinking about M&A and acquisitions. And what that means is when we arrive at a conversation, it is highly likely that the owners of that firm have already given thought to some of the very basic constructs around M&A. They've already thought about valuation. They've thought about what's important to my clients. They've thought about how do I want to think about my employees going forward and what's my role going forward.
So I think for our audience then, for firms that are thinking about their own future and what they're doing, one is become more prepared because the opportunities are there, the resources are there to do so, and enter into a conversation more substantively. Would you agree with that? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
I would also say, Scott, I mean, valuation, which is always front and center, right?
Yep.
It's an important construct here, the capital value that someone's created. Even though it is of primary importance, it has taken a little bit of a backseat, as Marty pointed out earlier, to things like culture and my people and how I think about the next 3 to 5 years. And I think the reason for that is there are a half dozen people or more intermediaries any RIA owner could call up and within a few minutes get a ballpark sense of valuation. It's going to depend, of course, on things like size and growth and client demographics and depth of team and fee structure and all that. But at the end of the day, there are pretty good zip code valuation metrics that are in the public domain. And so most advisory owners have a sense as to where they'll end up on value, which allows them to spend time on the things that are really important. The day after the check, you know, the check clears, how are you and your colleagues and your clients going to be treated? And what does the next 3 to 5 to 10 years look like? And so I think that's been a benefit.
Great. Well, that's exactly where our topic today of, so ultimately, what are we building in these larger enterprises? So one more question before we get into some of those specifics for you both. It seems like right now we're going through a bit of an inflection point, different pressures out there. I mean, we're seeing a rising cost of capital in the last few months, recent market declines, more in the PE space in the last several years. So in the last 12 months, you know, in our Fidelity monthly reporting identifies 20 firms which have each announced 3 or more deals over those 12-month periods. And these firms represent, those 20 firms, the deals they did represent about almost 80% of the activity and 2/3 of the associated client assets under management. So there are a lot of prepared serial acquirers out there actively reshaping of the space. So my question to you is, where is our industry headed over the next several years, and who will be the, quote, winners, if you want to call them that, as we continue to see greater concentration and consolidation?
So let me give you the soft and wonderful and empathetic answer, which is the winner is the end client. And I actually do think that's true. I mean, clearly consolidation is occurring at a more rapid pace today than it was 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. You know, interest rate and macroeconomic environment aside, that's not going to change materially. But it's an interesting industry, Scott. You know, there's no barriers to entry to get into the RIA business, but there are significant barriers for scale to have a large, profitable, growing business. And the implications of that are that new firms, new RIA firms, will continue to be formed on a regular and constant basis. And there will be some, but probably not many firms that are able to bridge the gap and become truly national in size and scope. It's just expensive and difficult to get to that size. And if we look out 5 or 10 years and the landscape continues, the landscape looks something like that, then the ultimate winner is the client, because the fiduciary model is growing and that's great for everyone. And clients will have a lot of choices as to whether they want a smaller, very intimate experience with probably less scale and capabilities, or they want a firm with broader capabilities.
Are we just headed back to the large wirehouse model of 30 years ago, where we're starting to see the reassembling of a number of smaller firms into a larger enterprise for scale? Is that what's going on?
I think, you know, first point, Scott, I would say, if that's actually reality, it's still better because it's a fiduciary model. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not product driven. But I think the number of RIAs are still growing. Even with all the consolidation and acquisitions, the count goes up every year. So I think really from my perspective, I mean, consolidation will continue. You will see more firms continue to grow above $100 billion in assets. And the clear differences in my mind are the differences in models from a holding company model to an enterprise model. And the recognition and understanding of that, I think, is what's ahead of us from a change perspective.
Define what you mean by a holding company model for our audience.
If the client is the winner, then there has to be a benefit to them. And the holding company model is simply the acquirer making multiple acquisitions, but owning those companies no differently than they were before. So they're not integrating them. They're not bringing additional tools and resources to the table. The enterprise model is the complete opposite of that. It's one organization that's fully integrated, that all the tools and resources of the organization are there for each and every advisor and location in that enterprise, versus the potential for each of those things having to be built in each segregated unit.
John, what are your thoughts on this?
I do feel the driving themes here are there will continue to be opportunities for advisor owners who are looking for a partner, right? To choose models, and you can choose the, as Marty pointed out, the CIs and the focuses, which allow you to be part of a, you know, kind of a corporate construct, but keep your, you know, keep some autonomy, versus a completely consolidated model, which is the models that our partner firms have chosen. So as an advisor own, you'll have the option of joining one or the other. You have the option of independence, and hopefully as financing, as financial backers get more comfortable with the industry and get a better understanding of the industry, there'll also be opportunities for, you know, internal transfers of ownership, because that's always an option that owners can look at. Currently, I think it's very difficult for second and third gen to gain the financing needed to buy a business. And the larger the business, just the more difficult that becomes, right? Because the business becomes much more valuable. So it's not always a viable solution, and it's not always attractive to the seller, but I think it will become a more viable solution going forward.
Let's go in a little more in depth on today's topic about how M&A is a means of creating a better and more competitive business. I know you've touched on a number of those issues already, but let's bring it a little more specifically to your own experiences, because I think each of you have brought unique approaches, one as a CEO and builder of one business, and the other as an investor in a number of players, in the case of John. Marty, what are you striving to build with each decision you've made? You've each done things more than just combine and add businesses together. You've actually made some conscious decisions, such as in your case, Marty, building out the Montage asset management business to an impressive $70 billion in assets, and then you sold it 4 years ago. What was behind that decision? And then where did you then refocus Mariner and the capital that you brought from that with those, you know, with those resources?
Yeah, I think if you go back to, you know, the days of us building Montage, I mean, there was an opportunity in the marketplace. The asset management side of the business, if you really think about it, it's different than wealth management. So if you have a hot product, a hot sector, a hot manager, it's like turning on the water faucet. Assets just flow in. But the same thing happens on the other side. If somebody stumbles, if something goes out of favor, you know, assets leave in two ways. Assets leave because the value of the assets decline with the market, but they also leave because clients leave. And the difference between that and the wealth management space is, you know, on the wealth management side, we get and lose clients one at a time. And while it may be slower to scale, there's not near as much volatility in it. And so in 2018, we made the conscious decision to sell our asset management division and reallocate all that capital to the wealth side, and reallocate it to the wealth side in the form of recruiting and in the form of acquisitions. And, you know, you asked the question, what's the decision-making process and what are you trying to build? And for us, it's one word, and that word is talent. We're in the game of making acquisitions because we're trying to acquire talent. And, you know, you think about, you know, our business, the wealth management space, the RIA business, and you can have advisors that are investment centric, planning centric, tax, estate, you know, trust company, retirement, insurance. All of those things can be specialties inside each and every one of these organizations. And from our perspective, that's exactly what we're looking for. We're looking to bring all of those individual expertise into our organization so that we can then surround them with tools and resources and fill the gaps and help the overall organization by making sure that the sum is greater than the parts.
Has that translated into attracting the types of firms you're bringing in and what they're looking for? What is it that's different for them in a decision like that for some of those capabilities, and how do they access them?
Well, I mean, I think what's different is the ability to access them. And, you know, John mentioned earlier that one of the barriers is scale, and that is correct. One of the other barriers is resources and whether or not firms choose to build them or not, and how fast they can build them and or attract the talent to do it. And so we just think about it from the perspective of one of the most overused words in our industry is holistic planning. Mm-hmm. And while it's overused, it's still extremely important. And we've just taken the approach that to truly be holistic, you must have the talent and the resource in-house. So to be a quarterback of a relationship and utilizing third parties to solve a solution, if that's what you have to do, that's what you have to do. We've chosen the other route and to bring all of those things in-house so that we can control the experience, both for our people, but more importantly for the client.
John, and you know, I mentioned you formed Wealth Partners Capital Group back in 2017. And for those who are more interested in the story, I'd encourage you to go back to our podcast that we did with MII and Rick Bunicore and you back in, I think, 3 years ago, where you talk about that a little bit. But you began it with three hub firms, Forbes Family Office, MII Capital, and EP Wealth. And in that time, you've completed over 50 transactions within those enterprises and a couple of additional firms. But you've also done some things where you've sold off the Forbes business. You sold off a significant portion of your MAI position, but you still retain a stake and you're still active with them and helping them with their M&A activity. EP Wealth has brought on another minority investor, and that's with your initial firms. I mean, since then, you've invested in Merit and brought in Appella and Warren Averett. I mean, that's a lot of activity in there, John. So help us understand kind of your own decisions in that as an investor in these firms and what you're trying to build and how that leads to some of the things Marty's talking about.
You know, when we launched in 2017, we realized we had, or we hoped we had, a particular expertise in wealth management and advisory, M&A, and inorganic growth. But we also recognized there's a lot we did not know, and we did not and don't know how to be great operators of great RIA firms. And so, you know, our first principle was, how do we partner with terrific management teams and partner in a way that we leave the complete operational control of the business in their hands? And when you say, you know, we sold, meaning Wealth Partners sold Forbes or sold a stake at, you know, as part of MAI, the answer is we actually didn't. The management teams came to us and said, we feel this is the right strategic direction for the business. We actually don't have the ability to dictate those kinds of, you know, events. And so our answer to the management team was, if you think it's right for you and your team and your clients, then it's right for us. And so we're happy to, you know, we're happy to help you engage and help figure out who the right next partner is. So we've always had this fundamental belief that great management teams of RIAs are difficult to find. And if we can find those teams and those teams have an interest in growth, you know, appropriate growth, and we can be helpful, we want to be partners with that firm. And so, you know, at the end of the day, many of the decisions that we're talking about right now operationally remain in the hands of our management team, and that's exactly the way we want it to be. I will say, though, that there are kind of three pillars we think about as we think about growth. You know, the first is it better for the client? And mm-hmm. Second, is it better for the firm and the meaning advisors and employees and partners? And third, is it better for shareholders? And the better for shareholders part isn't third because it's least important. It's third because if you do the first two and you do it well, right, you do it in an economically intelligent way, it'll almost always be better for shareholders. And so that's been our focus from day one. You know, as Marty knows, it's tough to find really great management teams in the independent space. Many of the firms that grow up are folks who grew up as advisors and either don't want to or are not particularly good at all of the day-to-day intricacies of running a larger business. And so our goal is to find those few teams that are equipped to do that and then reach out to like-minded advisors who have a real interest in serving clients, but maybe not a real interest in running a big firm.
You know, the way we describe it a lot of times is, you know, founders got into the business because they wanted to be elbow to elbow with clients. They wanted to give advice. And they were good at it, so they grew. And then they wake up one day and they're dealing with technology, HR, compliance, all the stuff. And so in our search for talent, there are individuals that want to do exactly what John just said, and they want to go out and help build an enterprise. There are equally or probably more of those founders that just want to be returned to the client. They want all of that noise removed from them so that they can just go give advice again.
In my work with consulting with firms over the last 15 years, I found that that's the inflection point that people reach, that do I really want to build and run a business, or do I want to get back to the serving and working with clients? They may be a little conflicted for a while. And I think firms like yours can really help them. John, I know one of the things I've heard you say before is that, you know, people want to join an organization that is growing, that has a sense of mission and so on. Can you say a little more about that? Because I think that's an important point that sometimes we lose sight of in the midst of all this M&A activity.
Sure. And I think, Scott, part of the, you know, part of where that observation originates is the fear that as firms grow larger, you will lose client connectivity. You'll lose the excitement of being part of something that's growing. You'll feel more like a cog in the machine. And, you know, the truth is that that can happen in large firms, but frankly, that can also happen in small firms. And size is, I think, one, but certainly not the only factor in thinking about how you continue to maintain intimate client relationships and a sense of entrepreneurism and a sense of making a difference and a sense of excitement. So other things that are important are obviously the organizational structure of the firm and where the decision-making rests, advisor independence around things like planning and, you know, investments and client relationships, compensation structures, the opportunity for advancement. All of that factors into how you keep a firm intimate and exciting, regardless of size and scale. And like you said, you know, a growing firm is an exciting place to be. And we think that if you want to attract the best talent, you've got to offer a platform and a business that has terrific opportunities, especially for younger people. I think the goal here is less about size and more about firm structure, opportunity, and client service.
So, John, I'd love it if, you know, I mentioned a number of the transactions that you've been involved in. Maybe you could touch on one or two that just help our audience understand some of the decision-making thought process and maybe some of the lessons you've learned from it. So, example, you know, MAI, you sold off a significant, excuse me, you worked with MAI who right. chose to do right. this.
Rick
just talk us through that because yeah. they were looking for something further. You almost, I think they were almost three times the size in terms of assets under management and probably as many offices from when you started working with them, but they were going a different direction. What was the decision there?
So you're right. MAI had grown rapidly during our partnership. Each firm has a kind of a unique DNA. It has a unique strategic thought process. It has a unique set of, you know, how it views its mission and service. You know, in Rick's case, I think Rick was anxious to think about how he takes the core philosophy of MAI, which really centers on client service, and bring it to as broad an audience as possible, as quickly as possible, and do it in a way that obviously doesn't sacrifice any of the, you know, the intense one-on-one client relationships, that doesn't sacrifice anything from a, you know, an employee or advisor perspective. And I think as he looked at our opportunity set going forward with MAI as a standalone entity, and then he looked at the opportunity set to serve a broader group of clients as part of a broader firm, a broader team, which is what the Galway team brought, a much kind of more extensive network of potential prospects and clients. Rick felt that given, you know, where he was in his business life, given where MAI was, that a partnership with Galway would allow us to do everything we were currently doing, but faster and better. And so our answer to that was terrific. You know, we're on board. There were other people who approached Rick, and those folks had either a different investment model or a different idea around compensation or a different idea of product orientation versus client orientation. And those conversations, you know, were just non-starters. As you might imagine, just like the folks that we approach get approached a lot, that gives us great perspective when we're approached on the right questions to ask. And Rick felt that he got all the right answers to all the important questions.
Well, that's a great example of how you're working with your the firms in which you invest to help them with kind of the direction they want to take their leadership. I think that's great. It's again, this is about a larger ecosystem out there too. It's clearly about an investment, but it's also about the kind of leadership. You know, I think Marty, you've referred that to post-deal. I think you have something you call Rule 113, which I'm sure you'll explain to us a little bit. But how do each of you in the firms you either work with, or in Marty, in your case, with your business, how do you strive to achieve greater benefit for your business with each deal? Maybe it's the revenue stream. Maybe it's the little bit about the structure or the capabilities you bring to the equation. You mentioned it's about talent. How do you help those advisors to be more effective at what they're doing and really engaged?
Yeah, so Rule 113, so the definition is 1 + 1 = 3. So we just decided to call it Rule 113. And, you know, John mentioned, you know, the three stakeholders or the three priorities. It's client first, associate second, shareholder last. And, you know, the way we think about that is if you, you know, the client has to come first. And you have to be building something that the value proposition and the client experience is elevated. And we really think about that from the perspective of diligencing the opportunities that we see from the client experience and value prop perspective and making sure that we want our brand on it. And assuming we want our brand on it, we don't mess with it. So we really think of things from the perspective of, you know, think about being on stage and there's a curtain. So front stage versus backstage. So front stage is everything that touches the client experience. We are not trying to build McDonald's or Starbucks. We want the uniqueness and the talent of each advisor to come through. And then we want to surround them with all the tools and resources that we can to fill in those gaps so that we are creating that Rule 113 environment for advisors and then therefore clients.
And Marty, one of the things that has been a distinguishing characteristic of what's built this business over more than 30 years is autonomy and independence. And I know we have a number of listeners who are like, you know what, I understand this. I see that, you know, the firms that Marty and John are involved in with are able to bring a lot of those capabilities. But I really like being my own boss, and I really like having that autonomy and independence. How should firms think about the capabilities and that tension between staying independent versus becoming part of an enterprise that builds that up? And how should they? What are some of the decisions that they need to work through?
When you think about autonomy and independence, what's that focused on? What piece of the organization or piece of the business is that important to you? If it's about the client and how advice is given and how the journey for the client unfolds, if it's about training and development of the next generation advisors inside your organization, if it's about those things, then we're aligned. That autonomy fully exists in all 67 of our locations. That is why we're partnering with those firms and those individuals and bringing them in the fold so that they can lead that for us. If you want autonomy in technology and compliance and HR and all the noise, then that's a different answer.
Right. That's the behind the curtain stuff that keep going, working with that if that's what you really enjoy. How do you sustain that entrepreneurial drive and creativity that's really important in a personal services enterprise? Is there anything more that you would add to what you just said, Marty?
One of the things that we focus a lot on is what is the profile of that firm and now location once it joins our firm? What's the profile of that 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, you know, after they've joined our organization? And so we look at it from the perspective of, you know, what's revenue look like? What's AUM look like? What's all of those things, right? But I think what's interesting is of all of them that we acquired between 2012 and 2020, just from a data perspective, firms that we've acquired after 2020, we haven't owned long enough. But from 2012 to 2020, the people count inside each and every one of those is more than 100% plus. The advisor count is on average 125% plus. So, you know, really giving them the ability to focus on, you know, building out the next generation advisor in touching more clients and serving more clients.
So I think the first cut is, if you as an owner, operator of an advisory firm, really have a kind of religious view of independence, there are clearly opportunities out there to join organizations, to benefit from capital value and make sure your employees and other shareholders are well taken care of and still maintain that autonomy. If you go into the enterprise model, which is where we live, I think it depends on what you mean by independence. We talk about this with potential sellers a lot. You're running your own business and you wake up on a Monday morning, you can do anything you want. It's your business. You can go sharp right, you can go sharp left. But chances are you're pretty much going down the highway in the middle of the road at about 55 or 60 miles an hour. And if that's all you ever intend to do, and you join a firm and it means that you can continue to do that, then life is good. Because if you're never going to take the extremes anyway, it's kind of a fallacy to think, well, I could if I wanted to. Maybe even though you could, it's not really important to you. And then other things come to the fore, right? So I think people have a concept of complete independence. And then the question is, what does that really mean day to day to you? And can you capture 80 or 90 or 100% of what's important to you in a model that still has more integration?
And sometimes I'm sure that just changes over the life cycle of running an enterprise. I mean, the startup phase is really exciting. You're building it, you're adding clients. But then as it's scaling and getting more mature, maybe you are beginning to reassess what you want. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. And that's true of all of us in life, I think.
Yes, I think that is very true. Well, for both of you then, I really appreciate the time that you've given us. I'd just like to see if you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share regarding your own inorganic strategies as business builders and investors and your commitments and what's helping you to build and reshape your firms.
I mean, I've used the word talent several times throughout this conversation, and I don't think I can use it too many times. I mean, this industry, by definition, is about talent. It's about individuals, you know, meeting with clients and helping clients achieve their goals. So I think the only thing that I would really mention is, you know, as people are thinking about this, considering it, trying to figure out where they fit in, take a step back, be purposeful. Valuations are important, but they're just a component of the deal. Fully understand what you want for you as an individual, but I would think more importantly, what do you want for your people and what do you want for your clients, and be purposeful about that.
Well, actually, Marty, our first podcast that you and I did almost 4 years ago, I think the message you talked about there is, who do you want to be in business with and what are you building together? And that how critical that interaction is, more so the cultural fit and alignment, more so than some of the other elements. And one of the things you did say there, you may remember too, which I thought was great, was I have two goals. Number one is keep clients. Number two is keep advisors. And the way you keep clients is by keeping advisors. And that plays back to your talent message. So I think those are welcome insights too. John, what about you?
Let me just step back. So I actually think, as I mentioned earlier, Scott, I think the outcome is always great for the end client, because, you know, we, meaning Marty, meaning Wealth Partners, meaning all of us involved in trying to build better, larger enterprises, all of that benefits the end client, because it just gives the end client in the fiduciary space more optionality. Whereas 20 years ago, if you wanted a true fiduciary advisor, you didn't have the ability to go to a large firm that had deep financial planning capabilities, that had trust and estates expertise, that had a broad investment menu, including complex alternatives. I mean, that just wasn't an option. That's an option today. That doesn't mean that every client will choose that option, but but those are options available. So I think all of what is happening in the industry is good in terms of client choices and options. As far as the RIA owners themselves, I would say it's a great time to be the owner of an RIA. I'm not sure the options ever get much broader. And frankly, I'm not sure the valuations get much higher than where we are right now. And so if I was speaking to someone who's running an RIA or wealth management business, I would say when the time is right, reflect, become educated on the options, understand the who, what, where, and importantly, know your own North Star. Know what is really important to you and to your firm and to your clients. And then given the alternatives available today, you will absolutely find the good and right long-term solution.
Well, John, like Marty, you've been nothing if not consistent with that message throughout. And I think that's really helpful. What I'm hearing from both of you is that we are on the, sometimes people look at scale and size and they get a little nervous about it. What I'm hearing from both of you is, frankly, this is at a tremendous inflection point in our industry for the better, because we're building deeper, more integrated organizations that can deliver a better fiduciary solution for clients. And that's going to continue to build. And the creativity and the innovation that I think so many people like in a smaller enterprise is more than available in larger enterprises, as they move on. So I think it's a great set of optionality that everybody has. Well, we hope this has been helpful for our audience today. I'm sure it has been, and given some tremendous food for thought for each person who's listening. I want to thank you, Marty and John, for returning to Future Ready through M&A. And again, as I did at the beginning, I encourage our audience to find those prior podcasts from 3 and 4 years ago and listen to those, because I think you'll get some deep wisdom and insight. And now you can see how both John and Marty and their teams have been carrying this out. Again, congratulations on the results that you've both achieved in building impressive organizations. And thanks for sharing your insight and wisdom with our audience. It's really been a big help.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
As a reminder, if you haven't listened to Season 1 or Season 2 yet, you can visit go.fidelity.com/mergers and acquisitions. Or you can find us on Apple Podcasts to catch up on past episodes. And I do encourage you to listen to some of these leaders who bring great insights on their perspectives on building these businesses. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast to get the latest M&A insights and to hear from firms like yours who have gone through a transaction. Find out what they've learned, what they'd never do again, and how they've grown as a result of the transaction. Well, that's it for us today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Future Ready through M&A. I'm Scott Slater, reminding you to be future ready.
Reference citations for this episode. Number one, first, the Cerulli reference data comes from Cerulli's 2021 USA RIA Marketplace 2021 Meeting the Demand for Advice report. Page 61 highlights that firms with greater than 100 million AUM have increased 8% from 2019 to 2020. Number two, additional M&A activity statistics are from the Fidelity Wealth Management M&A Transaction Report. Several sources are used to create this report. M&A data is gathered from press releases, trade articles, and other secondary research sources. All publicly announced transactions involving the acquisition of an independent advisory firm are reviewed for inclusion. The data shared in this podcast is representative through March 31st, 2022, for investment professional use or institutional investor use only. Information provided in this document is for informational and educational purposes only. To the extent any investment information in this material is deemed to be a recommendation, it is not meant to be impartial investment advice or advice in a fiduciary capacity, and it is not intended to be used as a primary basis for you or your client's investment decisions. Fidelity and its representatives may have a conflict of interest in the products or services mentioned in this material because they have a financial interest in them and receive compensation, directly or indirectly, in connection with the management, distribution, and/or servicing of these products or services, including Fidelity funds, certain third-party funds and products, and certain investment services. The third-party providers listed herein are neither affiliated with nor an agent of Fidelity and are not authorized to make representations on behalf of Fidelity. Their input herein does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information was provided by the third-party providers and is subject to change. The content provided and maintained by any third-party website is not owned or controlled by Fidelity. Fidelity takes no responsibility whatsoever, nor in any way endorses any such content. There is no form of legal partnership, agency, affiliation, or similar relationship among an investment professional, the third-party service providers, and Fidelity Investments, nor is such a relationship created or implied by the information herein. Third-party trademarks and service marks are the property of their respective owners. All other trademarks and service marks are the property of FMR, LLC, or its affiliated companies. Fidelity Institutional provides investment products through Fidelity Distributors Company, LLC, clearing custody or other brokerage services through National Financial Services, LLC, or Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, members NYSE SIPC. Copyright 2022 FMR, LLC, all rights reserved. 1035290.1.0, 1.9905964.100.